To order, it's Wednesday, April 27th, 2005, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 503. And there are really only two sets of amendments that we are going to address at this point in time, and that is the dash 8s and the dash 5s. And so I would like to have Rick Berkovian describe what each amendment does.
Thank you, Senator. Just briefly, in your packet, as opposed to the staff measure summary, our bulleted list, one showing the dash 5 amendments, Senate Bill 503-5, and then another showing the Senate Bill 503-8 amendments. These are basic gotten stuff amendments. The 505 first.
The dash fives.
Yeah. The dash five amendments again contain most of what the original bill did, and this is to create a certificate of need program for hospitals and other centers. What the dash 5 amendments do basically is pull out skilled nursing facilities, but does include hospitals, special surgical hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, diagnostic imaging centers, or oncology centers. It does require Department of Human Services to issue or for facilities to obtain a certificate of need or CON from DHS, Department of Human Services, prior to building or going into certain services. There's a list of established criteria which DHS is required to evaluate, and that's on the dash 5, such as documenting analysis need. They have to look at financial feasibility, impact on rates, impact on public and private payers, changes in utilization rates, that whole list of issues that would have to be the criterion for decision making. This would remove the applicant's entitlement to an informal hearing during the course of review, and instead they could request a hearing on the certificate of need after the director renders a final decision. The dash fives do require that the director or the DHS to issue the final decision on a CON within 90 days and not 60 days. The bill does establish that rural hospitals do not require a CON. On the next page, then, our other provisions of the bill, it says that CON does not apply to basic health services, but that renal dialysis is not a basic health services, so they would be included in the CON process, and that CONs would not be required of certain religious institutions, hospice facilities, alcohol or drug rehab, and such. There are some additional provisions in the dash fives, and these are bolded on that sheet. Requires a new skilled nursing facility, intermediate care service, or a special inpatient facility to obtain CON. Does allow the applicant to request a hearing following a final decision. Establish that provision does not apply to skilled nursing or intermediate facilities seeking to replace equipment with similar equipment. And the applicant must submit a letter of intent if the price of the replacement equipment exceeds $1 million. And then establish that a CON cannot be revoked unless it was obtained by fraud. Those are a very brief summary of the dash 5 amendments. The dash 8, again, you have a bulleted list with the heading SB 503-8. These, again, take out skilled nursing facility. The bolded and underlined part in the dash in the bulleted list shows what's additional in the dash 8s that are not in the dash 5. For example, it would expand existing health facilities with projected costs of $5 million or more if health facility is a hospital, or $1 million or more if it's other than a hospital. So the dash 8s include dollar criterion. Essence includes much of the same as in the dash 5. On the next page, though, it does require that before issuing a final decision about CON, that the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research would have to convene a review panel and evaluate the application. So that is one of the differences between the dash 5. And then again, you see some underlying wording at the bottom of that bullet list. And require the Oregon Health Policy Research Office, upon request of DHS, to convene a panel of Health Resources Commission to review the application for the CON and conduct a public hearing. That is a very brief summary, Sheriff.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Lynn Marie Kreider. And was she with the panel?
No.
Comment both on the dash fives and the dash eights.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lynn Marie Kreider, representing the Service Employees International Union. SEIU supported the original bill, Senate Bill 503, because we felt it dealt with the problem of a very high level of healthcare spending going into expanding healthcare facilities, and that necessarily pushes up the cost of healthcare to Oregonians. The bill established a planning process and expanded the scope of our certificate of need process here in Oregon. The key ways in which the original bill expanded the process were to cover relocations of existing hospitals, such as the situation we saw in Lane County, where Sacred Heart is spending $350 million to move a hospital from one location to another, and that is being done outside the certificate of need process. So the bill and the Dash 8 amendments would cover those kinds of hospital relocations as well as expansions of existing hospital facilities. The Dash 8 amendments, which we support, continue to cover hospital relocations and expansions, but use dollar thresholds to ensure that the certificate of need process doesn't need to come into play for every single very small cost expansion. The Dash 8s also establish the consultation process to which Mr. Berkobian referred in his analysis, which requires a kind of public examination and input into the CON process. A group of members of the Health Resources Commission, which is a body already established to look at the use of technology and other infrastructure in healthcare in Oregon, use that body to advise the director of the Department of Human Services in examining CON applications. So, and finally, the Dash 8s write into statute a set of criteria for granting or denying a CON application. SEIU is supportive of those amendments. We would oppose the Dash 5 amendments. We believe that those amendments basically they would cover, in addition to what's already covered, that is the building of new hospitals, the Dash 5s would cover ASCs, oncology centers, specialty hospitals, and so forth, which is fine. It's good to have a look at everything we're building, but it does nothing to deal with the larger spending issue, which is expansion by hospitals and relocations by hospitals. The Dash 5s also, well, I think I should leave it at that. I think that's the basic question, is do you or do you not want to have more public review of hospital spending for new hospital building? If you do, you want to support the Dash 8s. If you don't, the Dash 5s are a fine vehicle for a fight between the doctors and the hospitals, but they aren't a vehicle for trying to stem the overspending on health care in the state.
Questions? Okay. I'd like Bruce Bishop and whoever else you're going to have in your crew, just you.
Okay,
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. When we previously testified before the committee on this bill, we registered our opposition to the printed bill, the Senate Bill 503. We are here to support the Dash 5 amendments, however, because they have a very focused approach to reviewing new ambulatory surgery centers and other freestanding clinics. That basically has the effect of applying the same standards to those facilities that apply to other health facilities, including hospitals, nursing homes, and other licensed facilities in the state. Under current law, it is only those freestanding facilities that are not subject to certificate of need when they're built. Hospitals are subject to certificate of need for new hospital facilities, and our support of the Dash 5 is because it would apply the same standards to those facilities that are applied to hospitals. The particular problem that we are focused on is that not doing that has the effect of encouraging the proliferation of freestanding clinics without the opportunity to review how they're going to serve the community and what benefit they're going to give to the community. And those centers naturally and understandably will focus on the revenue-producing services that hospitals and community hospitals in this state need to keep their doors open. If those services move outside of the hospital setting into a freestanding center, the ability of hospitals to remain open and to serve their communities will be jeopardized. And our support of the Dash 5s is to take a single and focused approach to certificate of need just to address that problem without getting into the broader areas of regulatory review that the Dash 8s envision. We would oppose the Dash 8s as being unduly cumbersome, having the effect largely of subjecting hospital projects, expansions, remodels, whatever, to a regulatory process that will delay them, that will result in their costs increasing, but in all likelihood will not have a substantial effect on their ultimate approval, other than delay. That's the experience that Oregon had until the early 1990s, which is why the law was changed at that time to focus certificate of need on new hospitals and nursing homes without sweeping in ambulatory surgery centers. The Dash 5s would balance that approach and use certificate of need for that specific purpose. For that reason, we support the Dash 5 amendments, the Senate Bill 503.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. The scenario where an existing hospital does not provide a particular service and a clinic expands to provide that service. Now, under the certificate of need, the clinic should not have a problem getting a certificate of need. Is that what you're...
Chair, Senator Moore said, I think that would be a relatively easy review process for approval. Our concern is where... Mm-hmm. The freestanding center will have the effect of pulling those services out of the hospital altogether.
Okay.
If the hospital is not providing it, certificate of need will give an opportunity for there to be a review and for the community to decide whether it should be in an inpatient facility or an outpatient facility or in some other setting.
Follow-up. Yeah. Okay. Supposing there is a very large, successful clinic in operation and this bill, Dash 5s, pass, then would they be grandfathered in, or would they be subject to a retroactive certificate of need?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris said, the Dash 5s apply only to the new facility, so any existing facility would not be affected, and whether it's a hospital or a freestanding center, expansions, remodels, any of those improvements over time would not be submitted to certificate of need. The Dash 5s apply only to the construction of new facilities.
Okay, good. That one other thing. I guess I was kind of concerned about a hospital that says, well, we're already providing this, and yet they have started up and they're taking our customers away, and so Dash 5s would not, that would not impact them at all. It would be new facilities. Yes. Over $1 million, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said no. There is no,
there's no dollar threshold
five, so on the Dash. Any new facility, whether it's a hospital, an ambulatory surgical center, a diagnostic imaging center, or an oncology center, a new facility of those types would be subject to certificate.
Okay, that's okay. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Next is Scott Gallant, Mike Crew, and William. Scott Gallant? No, not Scott.
Mike Crew, Mike Crew, William.
Giveaway. My crew, William Mooney, and Sue Nance. Those are the three I want.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Crew. Our law firm, Cooney & Crew, is general counsel to the Oregon Medical Association. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today. The OMA is opposed not only to the Dash 5, the Dash 8s, but any other Dash plus the bill itself. We see no purpose in extending the certificate of need process over to physicians' practices. And let me give an example, a question more than anything else. The gentleman to my left here is Dr. William Mooney. He's the president and CEO of Oregon Hematology Oncology Associates, which is about an 8-office practice up in Portland that specializes in oncology. The question I have under the bill that I can't answer as a lawyer is, they deliver chemotherapy services within their offices. Presumably, if they want to take one of their 8 offices and relocate it, they're going to have to go through a certificate of need process because presumably they are a cancer center. That term is not defined in the bill. We don't know what a cancer center is, nor is it defined anywhere in Oregon law. So if nothing else, we need some definitions about what these organizations are. The same thing would apply to diagnostic test facilities. We don't know what that is. Many practices, the Portland Clinic, a group of primary care physicians, they have an MRI within their building, within their office. Does that mean if they change offices, they're going to have to go through a certificate of need process? We don't know. Another problem that the bill presents is, when does it take effect? And it kind of comes on the question asked by Senator Morissette. OHOA has expended hundreds of thousands of dollars and will soon commit itself to over $10 million in expenses to build out a very large facility. When this bill becomes law, it's probable that they will have that legal responsibility, but may be faced with going through a certificate of need process, which theoretically could be turned down. It puts them in harm's way. The bill, if it's going to be law, needs to be amended to allow organizations that are in process to proceed without going back to the CON process. And I might add, they started this many, many months ago, well before the legislature convened. This is not a response to Senate Bill 503. But with that said, and I'll try to keep this brief, and I do have some printed comments, and I'll put them on the table. There's only 3 communities in the state of Oregon that have multiple hospitals: Portland, Eugene, Medford. Everywhere else, it's a monopoly. And I can speak from personal experience because I negotiate these contracts. I've negotiated hundreds of them throughout the state on behalf of physicians and other facilities. And I can tell you that where there are ASCs, diagnostic test facilities, etc., the competition in healthcare has held down the cost of healthcare. Where there aren't such facilities, the costs go up. And this community is a prime example of that in Salem, Oregon. With that said, the other thing I would point out, that The bill itself is anti-competitive. If you look at the 2004 report of the Federal Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, they came out squarely against certificates of need. The Certificate of Need program arose out of a federal law that was passed in 1974 to try to get a handle on this unbridled investment in health care, because health care was basically reimbursed on a cost basis. So the more you invested, the more you made. That is not true today. By and large, health care is reimbursed, certainly at the hospital level, on DRGs, if you're the payor, or other set reimbursement in other programs. Either that or it's negotiated with the plans, the health plans that are out there. Physicians are reimbursed on a negotiated basis. And in many cases, and in virtually all cases, what an ASC is able to charge is much less than what a hospital-based service would be sold for or cost the patient. Without the existence of that competitive presence in the market, it's the opinion of the federal government that current technology will be withheld from the market and old technology will be rewarded. It is a fact that physicians as a group have brought technology to the market faster generally than hospitals in this state. If the certificate of need process goes in all probability that technology will be withheld for a longer period of time than necessary. And ultimately, the certificate of need process will not result in any reduction in healthcare costs. It will increase costs. That's the conclusion of the federal government in the 2004 report. And we would recommend to the committee to take a long, hard look at that report before a decision is made in this matter. Now, I can go on, but I won't, because I know you've got many witnesses, so I'll answer any questions any of the committee members might have.
Madam Chairman, my name is Bill Mooney. I'm a physician, president and CEO of Oregon Hematology Oncology Associates, or OHOA for brevity's sake. And Mike has mentioned a few things that address our concerns. OHOA started practice 25 years ago. There was two physicians and one employee in one office. Currently, we have nine offices with plans to open a tenth office in Vancouver. In addition to the Portland metropolitan area offices, we provide cancer services out of Newburgh and the Dalles, and subsequently in Vancouver. About 9 months or so ago, in order to curb some of the expenses of having our main office, which is on the west side of town, on the campus of one of the hospitals, we started exploring moving to other sites off campus to save money and also to explore offering additional services, namely imaging and radiation therapy. And what we would be, I'm not sure that we're not a cancer center as we exist now, but offering additional services to our patients in the convenience of a one office, one site, peaceful setting, quite different from the setting of a hospital setting where the parking and the activity and the lack of serenity is obvious to anybody that's been a patient getting care at outpatient care. When I started practice 25 years ago, our cancer therapies were relatively limited, but they were almost all provided in the hospital, in an in-hospital setting. Today, 95% or more of the cancer therapy is done in our offices in the outpatient setting, which is much more convenient. We believe a lot less costly, with fewer hassles for the patients, better access to care, and an environment that is conducive to quality for the patients. when we started exploring, currently we have an offer in on a piece of property for $1.3 million. We have we have 11 physicians currently and 5 nurse practitioners. We're expanding our the size of our practice by about 40% and have commitments to hire 4 additional physicians, partly to staff this new cancer facility. The process of hiring new physicians is a lengthy one and typically occurs about the interview process starts usually in the fall, a year prior to them actually arriving. So we've the process of us interviewing and hiring all these people is none of them have even arrived in Portland yet. Something that happens way in the future. So far, we've committed about $100,000 in architectural fees, legal fees, accounting fees, besides a lot of time and commitment on various people in the practice towards developing this cancer center, and really are in a quandary as to how this Dash 5 applies to us, and are very skeptical as to the this resulting in better care for our, this in effect could restrict our ability to provide the type of care and services we want to provide to our patients, and in the absence of any data that this would result in a cost savings to anybody other than allowing the hospitals to maintain some of their monopolistic stances on services.
Question.
Yes, thank you. OHSU is a cancer center, correct?
Well, there is no. I don't know what a cancer center is, what the definition of a cancer center is. I guess one could say that we have currently 9 cancer centers that provide. Some diagnostic procedures. We employ about 25 RNs to deliver the cancer therapy in the offices, and are looking at one of our sites to adding additional services besides the laboratory.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sue Nance, and I am the nurse administrator from Bend Surgery Center in Bend, Oregon, and I'm also the president of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Association. And the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Association is opposed to all the amendments or any bill that would name a certificate of need for an ambulatory surgery center. Ambulatory surgery centers provide high-quality care and alternative, cost-efficient places for surgeries to be performed. These facilities save Medicare and all third-party payers and beneficiaries lots of out-of-pocket expenses based upon their copay and the facility fees rendered in that facility. I have a handout that you should have in front of you that kind of covers some of those reimbursement fees that ambulatory surgery centers receive, which is significantly less than what a hospital receives. On the back of the handout is a pie chart that shows you the payer mixes that ambulatory surgery centers serve, and it's pretty comparable to what the hospitals are doing. And if you notice on that pie chart, it's showing that we're taking the same amount of Medicare, Medicaid, so we're not skimming the cream off the crop, which I've heard in the past from some of the hospital associations. The methodology of payment for services provided in ASCs is based upon a group payment system set by Medicare. And in the chart just below on that first page kind of goes over those reimbursement fees. So there's only 8 payment methodologies that are applied to surgery centers. For the same procedures that are done in a hospital, they have 120 payment methodologies. Some of the differences can range as high as 120%, where a hospital is paid more than what an ASC is paid. An example would be on a cataract surgery, an out-of-pocket expense for a Medicare patient is $189 compared to $460 that they have to come up with as an out-of-pocket expense to a hospital. So you can see the difference in that reimbursement rate. ASCs are saving money for Oregon patients. We also contract based on this group payment system, a percentage of that Medicare rate. This payment includes all medications, all dressings, pre-op care, post-op care, any laboratory services that are done in that facility, where the hospital has the ability to do a line item billing on a lot of those services. So, once again, it's not apples to apples in comparison to that payment and cost. So by applying that CON to an ambulatory surgery center, which is defined by the Federal Register as an extension of a physician's practice, is going to increase those costs significantly, because a physician who is building an ASC does not have the dollars to put, you know, like a foundation and those kinds of things to develop these centers, and then to apply the cost of a CON, which I read in the Department of Health Services, to range between $10,000 and $25,000. That's just the application fee. That's not including the attorney fees, all the time and the effort, and dollars amount to collect the information that's required. I've heard of fees ranging up to $75,000 to $100,000 based on costs that would require these physicians to do. So that kind of expenditure over and above the construction costs and cost of doing business would potentially prevent ambulatory surgery centers from being built, thus preventing access to quality, cost-efficient care to all Oregonians. You know, Mr. Moody made reference to the Federal Trade Commission as the CON as being something that restricted trade, drove up health care costs, and it's a concern to me to see that. I mean, we provide a very busy facility over in Bend, Oregon. And in our particular environment, there's one hospital that provides the same service. They also own the hospital in the next town. They run the hospital in the other town, and they're looking at trying to potentially manage another. So by having that kind of monopoly, it's going to drive healthcare costs significantly up. So as an administrator, as a member of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center, and as a nurse, we oppose these amendments.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions regarding ambulatory surgical centers. And are you required, like hospitals, to not turn anyone away?
We are not bound by EMTALA, which is based upon emergency room treatment. We provide elective outpatient care. So this is, we do not provide trauma care. We do not provide emergency care. We do not turn people away. We do some charity care. We do Medicaid. We do Medicare if it's on that procedure list. Ambulatory surgery centers are only allowed to do 2,500 procedures based upon the CPT code methodology, where the hospital has free rein to do every CPT code in that book. So with a Medicare patient, we cannot do a procedure such as a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. That has to be done in a hospital, because CMS or Medicare has a list of procedures that they deem safe to be done in an outpatient setting.
Okay, so you do, so it's elective.
Correct.
And then your hours are usually then daytime hours, right? You're
correct.
Usually just, okay. Okay. Further questions? Thank you. David Fryfield, Michael McKay, John Urkella, and Judy Corwin.
Yeah. Be nice to him.
Okay.
Okay. I want to be done by 2 on these.
Jump over the back or something.
Okay, sir.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. David Freifield. I'm a radiation oncologist. I am the medical director of the Willamette Valley Cancer Center in Eugene. I also have an office in Springfield and one in Florence. I'm here today representing the 11 oncologists from the Cancer Center in Eugene and also the 33 oncologists with our affiliated group, Northwest Cancer Specialists. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in opposition to the inclusion of outpatient cancer treatment facilities in the certificate of need process. I don't have to tell you that cancer is a common disease today. The American Cancer Society estimates that nearly 18,000 Oregonians will be diagnosed with cancer this year. It is now the leading cause of death of those under age 85. The bad news is that the number of people with cancer will be going up every year in Oregon as the population ages. Cancer has changed radically over the last 20 years. It was once a death sentence. Today there are millions of cancer survivors. Cancer treatment was once almost solely based in hospitals. Today, 80% of cancer care occurs in an outpatient setting. At the Willamette Valley Cancer Center, somewhere between 150 and 200 people visit us each day. We begin seeing patients at 7 in the morning and go till about 6 or 6:30 in the evening. To answer the question that you asked the last speaker, we have yet to turn anyone away in the 7 years that we've been open. We're an integrated cancer facility. Patients who can receive chemotherapy, radiation treatments, undergo diagnostic laboratory testing, X-ray or CAT scan. Some meet with a dietitian, social worker, or attend a support group. Cancer treatments are typically not one-time treatments. Patients are treated over several months, sometimes coming into the center daily, and many patients continue to work during that period of time. That's the scope of the problem. It is not one of excess capacity today in this state. The problem is availability of care and access to services. Quite frankly, we're scrambling to keep up with the growth.
May I?
Yes.
Do you have written testimony?
Do you have written testimony?
I do not.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that... Then I'll take notes. while I have your attention, please,
yes.
May I?
Yes.
What was the remark that you made about increasing amounts of cancer until you reach 85? I don't understand that. I've heard that if men lived long enough, they would all get prostate cancer. That's what somebody said the other day. I don't necessarily believe that. But what is the significance of the age 85 that you mentioned?
Madam Chair, Senator, let me clarify that. In the past, the largest cause of death in this country was heart disease. And thanks to the excellent work of the cardiologists and the cardiac surgeons in this country, the number of people dying of heart disease has declined significantly in the last 10 to 15 years. Our reward for that is more cancer. So as people age beyond 85, heart disease is still the leading cause of death. But if you look at the group under the age of 85, just in the last year, cancer has become the leading cause of death in that group. And as the population is aging, the baby boomers just now have hit the age that we would consider to be the cancer age. And as the baby boomers move through that age, there's going to be a steadily increasing amount of patients with cancer needing cancer services for the next 20 years or so.
Yes, we need to. Are you just about finished?
I am.
Okay.
Two things. What we need in cancer care is to increase the capacity, not to restrict. We need more integrated and coordinated care. We need increasing technology, CAT scans, MRIs, and PET scans. Those things are expensive. There's no question about them. But there are going to be people who need those services. And we need to continually upgrade the technology. And the certificate of need will do nothing to face the problems that the cancer patients are going to have today or in the future. On the other hand, it probably will restrict. Restricting access is not going to reduce the healthcare costs, but it is going to affect the quality of life of patients and their families. One group that's left out of this discussion is typically the patients. And I've asked Mr. Michael McKay to accompany me today to give that perspective.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, Senators, I was very pleased that I was able to come up here to point from a different...
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Mike McKay. Mike McKay. I live in Springfield, or just north of Springfield, and I am being treated, or I was being treated at the Willamette Cancer Center. At the present time, my wife is being treated there. We had a 20-day break in January from the time I finished my last treatment until she was diagnosed with cancer and went in. I was treated under radiation under Dr. Fifield's care. My wife has both radiation and chemotherapy. I don't know if there's any way that people that haven't gone through this can understand the stress that is involved to the patients. A center that is strictly for the treatment of cancer and is thorough, in other words, you can have chemo and radiation in the same facility at the same time, the same day, having your PET scans, X-rays, etc., in that same facility, having a pharmacy in that facility, having the dietitian, which, believe me, the diet is very, very important, having your dietitian in that same facility. Every time you go in, you can see these people, these things can be done, is extremely important. The comfort that you have in a facility that is designated strictly for one treatment of one thing, such as a cancer center treats cancer, you don't have the being sent off to some other facility to have your X-ray taken and have it come back in a few days. You can have it done, and in 5 minutes, your doctor will be looking at your X-ray. It isn't being done in an X-ray facility somewhere in a different town. That's great. In my wife's case, where she is taking both chemotherapy and radiation at the same time, the oncologists can talk to each other. They know if there's a reason for a radiation therapist or physician to talk to for a chemo oncologist, they can do it. They're in the same building. They work for the same people. They do the same thing. If there's a need for a drug or a new pharmacy need, the pharmacy is down the hallway. You get it there, then. These places absolutely are the only way to be treated, to tell you the truth. They unless you have to have surgery, which obviously is going to be done in a surgical hospital, that's fine. But for any other type of treatment for cancer, the degree of comfort is, in my opinion, really, really adds to the healing process. The knowledge that these people are all, that you're there, they're interested only in your disease and what they're doing to cure it. I personally feel that any restrictions put on them in adding to their facilities would be detrimental to the patients. I do not understand in my mind how putting more restrictions on their ability to improve their facilities can possibly make it better for the patient. I just don't understand that.
Thank you. Yes, Senator George.
It's more of a comment than a question, Madam Chair, if you would. My dad fought cancer about 25 years ago, and what you articulated is so accurate relative to what he said, that the way the system was structured then, you had to go here for one thing, there for another thing, and I think the turmoil probably cost him more in his ability to fight this disease than anything else. because of the not only the emotional recognition of fighting cancer, but then the trauma that was involved with having to go place to place. And I've been so pleased to see the innovation that's come in to satisfy so many of the concerns that he said way back then. And I want to thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
And just to let you know, the certificate of need would not affect your facility that you're in, that you have been a part of.
Madam Chair, but it would affect your ability to expand, correct? It could affect your ability...
Not expansion.
No, to another city.
Or another site.
And Madam Chair and Senator, that's what we would anticipate with growth in the area. We see the need for expansion, maybe not next year, but in the relatively near future, I think that would happen.
Yeah, this doesn't affect relocation or expansion of an individual facility. It would be only for new facilities. But this is one thing that I'm glad that the issue was raised, because the definition, we need to have that clarified in the bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Judy Corwin. I represent the 75 doctors and the 460 staff who work in healthcare at the Corvallis Clinic, 3680 Northwest Samaritan Drive in Corvallis. And the doctors and staff have been providing healthcare in Oregon in that community since 1947. And I want to thank you for allowing physicians to speak today. This is important. Several of our doctors wanted to come and testify today. I've brought one of them with me here today who will speak after I do, but some of them could not reschedule their time because they had patient appointments today, so they could not come. In the interest of time, I've provided you a copy of my written testimony, and I will try and summarize my comments. I'm not going to go over a lot of studies because I think you've heard them all, but I'm going to try and make my comments based on what physicians have told me. We are opposed to Senate Bill 503. We disagree that a government regulatory process for certificate of need will help Oregon's healthcare system. We're opposed to the amendments and feel that they would force the smaller healthcare facilities in Oregon with an additional burden of certificate of need. We think that the certificate of need concept is outdated. It doesn't reduce costs in healthcare. In fact, it might raise them. It doesn't improve patient care, and that because the financial process for the way certificate of need happens, and because the healthcare system has changed, that the certificate of need regulations would have an even greater negative impact on smaller facilities. And let me explain that a little further. Certificate of need was a relic of the 70s and the 80s. At that time, all states were required to adhere to a strict certificate of need policy, and healthcare was funded in a different way. It was funded based on cost. And certificate of need was used to prevent the explosion of unneeded facilities and the flood of expense. Well, those days don't exist anymore, and you've heard other testimony already to explain to you how the model has changed. Today, the financing model is such that many states have a limited certificate of need measure. They've eliminated them since the federal government removed the restriction. And only a small number of states require an aggressive use of certificate of needs, and most of these are in the eastern United States. Those same costs have much higher health care costs than in our state of Oregon. Most of us would agree here that the increasing cost of health care is being driven by patients who expect the best in medical care. And I would anticipate that if we're sick, that expectation would apply to all of us in this room. The increasing cost of health care is due to medical technology and prescription drugs as well. And adding certificate of need will not control these cost drivers. In fact, limiting competition could increase the cost of health care. Certificate of need is outdated, for large and small organizations, but it's even more harmful impact on the smaller organizations such as ambulatory surgery centers, physician groups, and a number of others that are listed in the bill. Physicians and doctors' clinics in Corvallis and dozens of similar physician clinics across the state, such as Roseburg and Bend and Coos Bay, Eugene, Salem, and Portland, they work in private clinic environments. And as primary caregivers, they deliver care to millions of Oregonians. Most of these doctors provide care in all kinds of facilities, including the local nonprofit hospitals. As private business, our clinic cannot succeed if we choose to add a piece of equipment or build a facility that doesn't make financial sense. Unlike the medical models before, where you got cost paid for your cost of doing care, that no longer exists today. And any expansion of the facilities needs to be based on a business model. That business model does a better job of controlling costs, the market, than government regulation. The smaller the healthcare provider, the more burdensome a certificate of need will be. And ironically, these are the same facilities that provide efficient care, high-quality care, at lower cost. We believe we need a healthcare system that encourages a wide range of providers. If a patient needs to go to the emergency room, if a patient needs to go to the intensive care unit, that there's a specialist there to take care of them. And if a patient needs minor surgery, then a physician should be able to take care of that patient in an outpatient setting. Most of these smaller facility alternatives generate savings for the patient, access for the patient, especially in smaller communities, and savings to the rest of us who pay health insurance. For large hospitals who have a larger administrative capacity, while certificate of need may be a bad idea, they have the administration and the ability to put together a certificate of need application and take it through the process. For a smaller clinic or a rural healthcare clinic, such as the doctors in Corvallis, it will take a significant amount of added financial and human resources, and this will add costs. It's very simple. If you believe that specialty hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers can provide high-quality health care at lower costs, then applying certificate of need to these smaller operations makes no sense. In fact, it could keep them out of the marketplace, and it could increase their costs. So certificate of need does not control costs. It does not improve patient care. In fact, it adds bureaucracy that could discourage investment in these types of facilities. I'll be happy to take questions, but before I do, I would like to introduce Dr. John Urkola, who is here today to testify. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the time to address you on this particular subject of certificate of need. My name is John Urkola. I'm a practicing orthopedic surgeon in Corvallis, Oregon, and I've been a member of the community and of the medical, of the personal community and the medical community for 26 years. In the time that I've been there, I've been very active in hospital activities and actually had served on the Good Samaritan Hospital Board for 8 years. I've been president of the medical staff. Currently, I'm involved with peer review issues of ethics and quality assurance, both at the Corvallis Clinic and at Good Samaritan Hospital. I don't remember if I said I am a member of the Corvallis Clinic, but I thought that would be obvious with Judy's introduction, but that's been my sole place of practice in my time there. You've already heard excellent testimony, and I'm going to try and keep my comments brief and summarize them. I think one of the things that's very important in this debate or in considering this issue is that we're not dealing with a consumer. The patient is not a consumer. The patient is an individual. The patient is you. The patient is me. And providing quality, I think three things are important. One is that we need to assure, one, quality care. Two, we need to provide access. And I think we need to work on controlling costs. And these are what truly benefit a patient in the long run. As a physician, I am opposed to the concept of certificate of need. I just don't feel it fulfills any of the three goals that I mentioned above. And I would like to focus my comments basically on three issues. One is the lack of effectiveness and equity of the certificate of need process. The second is the advantages of freestanding ambulatory surgery centers or specialty care centers. And three, the potential ethical concerns of physicians owning and participating in freestanding centers. The certificate of need, as has been pointed out, the certificate of need process really, I believe, is outdated. Mr. Crew pointed at the study that was done by the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice, and they had concluded that the certificate of need process really provides anti-competitive risks that really outweigh its benefits. Or at least that was their conclusion. It allegedly allows people in the market, in this care, the healthcare market, to prevent other competitors from really coming in and participating in the care. And it concluded that because of the anti-competitive barriers, costs may actually increase. As Ms. Corwin pointed out, the cost of, well, has been pointed out previously, the cost of a successful certificate of need is somewhere between $75,000 and $100,000. And that may be more than the profit margin of many smaller groups and many smaller organizations. Additionally, it presents a competitive disadvantage to smaller groups because their bottom line and their financial resources are not as large as our larger healthcare systems. In Oregon, if one looks at the costs, we already have a very low cost of medicine as compared to the nation. And resurrecting really a certificate of need process, in my opinion, is a move in the wrong direction. Ambulatory surgery centers, as has been pointed out, ambulatory surgical centers have a significantly decreased cost as compared to hospital outpatient surgical departments. Remuneration for the two is different, as was pointed out to you, and you already have the statistics. I think that the reasons are simple. One, the reason that the ambulatory surgical centers can be less costly are that, one, they're more effective. Number two, they have specialized staff. The facilities are focused to do a specific task. There's less delays, there's more convenient scheduling, and it allows physicians greater time to be accessible to other patients who might need services. The decrease in cost was verified by a study that was commissioned by the American Ambulatory Surgical Center. This was done by the Moran Corporation. And this study concluded that, or pointed out, that the average outpatient surgical cost in a hospital outpatient surgical center or outpatient surgical setting was $891. In an ambulatory, in a freestanding ambulatory surgical center, that cost is reduced to $571. This is a reduction of $320 per average service provided. And then it goes on, the study went on to conclude that would save Medicare about $1.6 billion a year. I just think that's an important figure to note. Also, since the fees for ambulatory surgical centers are less than those for hospital outpatient facilities, hospitals have no incentive to proceed with seeking to establish these. As a matter of fact, they may well have an incentive to prevent these from being established.
The one we wind up.
Pardon?
We need to keep moving.
Okay, I have about 1 minute. There's one allegation that physicians would be skimming the cream, and I just like to point out that hospitals are the setting for care. The physicians provide the care at the Corvallis. Well, we provide the care in emergency rooms, in hospital, as well as in our own offices. Just as one point, at the Corvallis Clinic, we provided over $2 million in direct charity care, not including any discounts for write-off. My conclusion is that the certificate of need process is really one that does not decrease costs, and it potentially will increase them. Competition promotes high care, accessibility, and cost-effective health care. Effective enforcement of antitrust laws can help to prevent the competition. That concludes my statement.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. All right. Now we will go to Craig Fausel and Scott Gallant, Paul Cosgrove, and Douglas Walta. Okay. Yeah, we're starting to get people saying the same things over that we've already heard. So if you have some new information, we would appreciate it.
May I proceed? Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me address Senate Bill 503. I'm Douglas Walta. I'm a gastroenterologist, president, CEO of the Oregon Clinic. It's a 100 physician or provider specialist clinic, 400 employees, serving the Providence Health System, Legacy, Tuolumne, Salem hospitals. The Oregon Clinic has a very strong commitment to social justice and actually concern for the unfortunate Oregonians. And I bring a copy of a letter validating that commitment from Multnomah County. I'm here today for two reasons. We're very concerned about this Senate bill. We're in the process of just close to breaking ground. We've invested a large amount of money in a new building. We're going to be moving some of our facilities there. This bill will be devastating. It could destroy the clinic, literally. And Dr. Fossil will address that. I also want you to seriously consider just the whole idea of certificate of need. The Oregon Clinic cares for the poor in our ancillary offices. We participate in every Medicaid, managed and non-managed care and open card. We take care of all Medicare and non-managed and unmanaged. Our contributions and community write-offs using a formula that Providence Health Systems uses demonstrated that we had a community benefit of $10 million, and we've done it every year, which is more for amount that we do than they do compared to revenue. Yet we're a for-profit organization and we pay taxes, unlike the nonprofits. The procedures we do are efficient, and I'm not going to elaborate on that, but it is why Blue Cross and every healthcare insurer contracts with us, because we're much less in cost. We're also more efficient, and you've heard that. Our problem is, in addition, that we have a limited number of docs. Yes, we're 100 providers, but to try to get in to see Dr. Doug Walta will take you 2.5 months. To schedule a procedure takes another 2 months. If I had to do all those procedures in the hospital, it would take 4 months. And you kind of say, that seems ridiculous. But unfortunately, it's true. To try to impair our efficiency because we have a physician and nurse shortage in this state that is very impressive. To impair our efficiency makes no sense, and this potentially could. To protect a system that costs twice as much per case makes less sense, but to create a process where physicians are unable to care for the poor in our ASC makes even less sense. There are over 500,000 Oregonians in this state uninsured. We know that access is a problem in this state for the Medicaid population particularly. Yet it is our social and ethical obligation to care for them, and we do. If we're efficient, we can do it well. If we're inefficient, we really can't do it. And in truth, some of the revenue from our ASC gets shifted over to care for this population. Clearly, if we lose this, our ability to do that and offer care for this population will diminish, which will be devastating for us, our mission, as well as for the unfortunate in the state. We're trying to attract the best and the brightest to this state. We're trying to have a system set up so it's efficient, that we can have a salary that's commensurate with the rest of the competition throughout the nation. Physicians are facing this all over the country. Nurses are facing this all over the country. There's a huge competition for this group. Bend Clinic, Portland Clinic, Corvallis Clinic cannot recruit a gastroenterologist right now. They're struggling. If our salaries are remaining where they are, we're in trouble. If we have a way to care for the poor and have revenue enhancement, we're looking for it, and we'll continue to look for it. Basically, in summary, we're going to continue to care for the poor in the Medicaid population as long as we financially can. Our ability to work efficiently and profitably depends apart on having our own system that we can control. It'll benefit the payers, our patients, and the entire healthcare system, and it will not increase the cost. It'll lower the cost. I urge you to not support the certificate of need.
Thank you.
My name is Craig Fossil. I am also a gastroenterologist. Doug Walter is my partner. You have my written testimony. I'm obviously going to abridge that considerably in the interest of time. And although if you're looking for something to read tonight, it sort of summarizes everything that everybody else has said. I am, again, a full-time gastroenterologist. I am sort of a full-time vice president of the Oregon Clinic. Doug has described our group. And unfortunately, an amateur testifier, but I appreciate your patience with me. And I'm going to abridge my comments. I would like to emphasize, though, that the Oregon Clinic, and I think all the physicians of the state, have shown commitment to the hospitals and the care of the patients in the hospitals and success of the hospitals, and we've demonstrated that over and over again. Unfortunately, it seems to be part of this is a tension between the hospitals and the physicians, I believe, for control of these services, and I think we just ask not to be unfairly disadvantaged in this. The state of Oregon required recruiting the best and brightest physicians here. I can tell you, if we have unfair limits on what physicians can do to provide for care, the best care for their patients, we won't be able to recruit. And that's a serious problem in the long term, I believe. We have to have the ability to have good facilities, the best facilities for our physicians to attract them. And finally, I would like to address specifically a problem that we have with the Oregon Clinic and request that if a CON bill is going to be passed, that there be a provision for exemption of facilities that are already in planning. The Oregon Clinic is in the process of not only planning, but about to break ground on a $30 million facility, which is an outpatient facility, an endoscopic outpatient ambulatory surgery center, which we have one already, but it'll be moving it, so I guess this legislation would apply, a medical oncology infusion center, imaging and laboratory services. We have been working on this for well over a year. And you can imagine our surprise and our anxiety about being presented with, all of a sudden, this certificate of need legislation that may limit our ability to do this. We have spent over $1 million so far. We are working with the City of Portland, the Portland Development Commission, and TriMet to do this project. And I'm not exaggerating, and Doug said the same thing, that if we're not able to proceed with what we've planned already, we may well be for disastrous consequences, including bankruptcy of the clinic, and the consequences that would have for the citizens of the east side of Portland, and actually for the citizens of Oregon, since we see many patients from all over the state. So I hope that although we oppose entirely the CON legislation, I would hope that you would look, if you do pass such legislation, to include exemptions for those, such as the Oregon Clinic, who've already embarked on programs and embarked on buildings, and others who are doing so as well, to exempt us from those requirements. Thank you. And again, you have my written testimony. If you'd read that later, I'd thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gallant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. You have my testimony. I will make two or three points and be brief, which I gathered, Madam Chair, you would appreciate even earlier in your comments about whether I was testifying or not. First of all, it's really clear from our perspective that the issue of creating a level playing field is not solved by this legislation, any of the amendments that have been provided to date. Two, there is no evidence that ambulatory surgical centers, oncology centers, or the other inclusions of these centers, in fact, are harming the ability of hospitals to gather resources, to see patients, in this state. As you know from previous testimony by Dr. Goldberg on what their operating margins are and reserves are in this state. But most importantly, I think, one of the suggestions is that these facilities are developed to duplicate services. I'll give you one quick example of why this is somewhat ironic. In the city of Portland, one hospital facility decided to build two diagnostic centers across from existing practices of physicians who have privileges at that facility, have provided services to that facility for years. They've hired physicians to staff those facilities, and I would suggest that that appears to be somewhat duplicative for no reason that I'm aware of other than trying to internalize those services, even though it wasn't necessary. The OMA would agree with SEIU on opposing the Dash 5 amendments. We would agree with the Hospital Association in opposing the Dash 8 amendments. And I would also want to point out, I'm sure labor appreciates this, they quite often, by the way, build these facilities. I would also point out that the comment that the Dash 8 amendments would not have an impact on the ultimate approval of hospital services or facilities is as applicable to the Dash 5 amendments as they are to the Dash 8 amendments. My experience in the past with the certificate of need process is that the projects are ultimately approved at a higher cost. It's just a matter of at what time is it approved. Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's see. Paul, yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll only make 2 points because I can't be longer than Scott. Paul Cosgrove, for the record, representing the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center. I agree with Lynn Marie Kreider. Healthcare cost increases are a problem. It just seems that a solution that increases the costs of the most efficient providers of those healthcare services is not a logical path to tread. I also agree with Mr. Bishop that certificate of need processes in many cases just, as I think he put it, delay the process and increase costs but do little else. We would request that you oppose the Dash 8, oppose the Dash 5 for the reasons Mr. Gallant just so eloquently stated, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. All right. I just have some specific questions regarding the certificate of need process. Is there someone in the audience that could answer those questions? Barney Spate, all right.
You should have stayed down on the front porch, Mark.
You know, there seems to be a great fear that if we have a certificate of need process, that it's going to delay, it's going to prevent at least the ambulatory surgical centers from occurring. Can you just give a little bit of history of certificate of need in the state of Oregon, and all of a sudden we got rid of it, and now can you just give us a little bit of history there and then how it works?
Madam Chair, for the record, Barney Spate. I am appearing today on behalf of the Director's Office of the Department of Human Services and not in my usual role as the Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Both Mr. Weeks and Janet Fusel, who is the Administrator of the Certificate of Need Program, couldn't make today's hearing, so I was enlisted. The shortcoming is I'm not an expert in Certificate of Need today, but like many of the folks that have testified, we've been around the process for 20 years, and I can give you a little bit of the history. I think one of the earlier witnesses indicated that certificate of need arose out of the health planning movement or acts of federal government in the 70s. And at one time, Oregon, like many other states, had a very comprehensive certificate of need related to hospitals that included not only the construction of new hospitals, but any major renovation or the acquisition of new equipment. And at one time within the Oregon statute, they were pegged at different levels of expenditure, whether a project would qualify or would not, or would require a certificate of need or would not require a certificate of need. And that proceeded for a number of years. Another witness made the comment that one of the changes that came about in the financing of American health care, and for those of us in Oregon, was the beginning of the change of reimbursement systems away from particularly the federal government, cost-based reimbursement, and more into prospective reimbursement like DRGs, et cetera, that had a much more moderating effect on capital investment by large healthcare institutions. And with those changes in reimbursement across the country, there was a corresponding change in certificate of need. And I can't, I don't have the definitive history, but at several years ago, the Oregon legislature made the decision that we would limit the our certificate of need program basically to the new construction of a brand new hospital or nursing homes. And it was very limited. Some states repealed certificate of need in its entirety. We narrowed it where it has a very, very narrow impact now. The history of certificate of need relative to process is a application process, in some cases extensive application process, and you note in both the dash fives and the dash H and the other dashes that are out there, a review process using certain criteria, making findings, and then the in this case the Department of Human Services making a finding to issue a certificate of need, the applicant can proceed with construction. In the finding of not of approval, there is by law the opportunity to appeal that decision. Originally, the appeals process in Oregon actually had a body called the Certificate of Need Appeals Board, which was a citizen-based board with people from healthcare, consumers, purchasers, etc., and they were the appeals body and a step finally to the courts for a review. The current system, I believe, is that I know there's no Certificate of Need Appeals Body, but there is because it is an administrative action of a government entity. It's appealable to a court. There is undoubtedly in history, my history with the Certificate of Need, there is time, investment of resources, consultants, et cetera, in putting together a Certificate of Need application. The fees, the current state law provides that the fees are established based on the complexity and the scope of the project. The concept being is that a highly complex, for example, the building building of a 200-bed new hospital or substantial $100 million remodel is a much more complex process than some others. So there I don't have the specifics on the fee schedule, but it is intended by statute, by policy, to be, if you will, a sliding scale based on complexity and scope. Let me just summarize, Madam Chair, from the point of view of the department, speaking on behalf of the director's office. We have no position on 503. I think there is probably some interest on what are the budgetary or fiscal aspects of these bills. And I would just comment that at least for the 05-07 budget, because this program is fee-based and we have the ability through rule to establish the fees, and we also have, and it's other funds. There's no general fund that supports the current Certificate of Need program. Is that we see no fiscal impact for this biennium because, one, it's other funds, it's fee generated, and the department as a whole has excess limitations, excess fund other fund limitations that would allow us to expend those funds pursuant to those expenditure limitations. I think that in both both cases of these bills, we as the agency that would be called upon to administer it, there's some doubt about being accurate to tell you what the workload would be in 05-07, and I would imagine that if this were, either of these were to become law, that in the 07-09 budget, there would be a much more definitive staffing, other funds kind of analysis for that budget cycle. Lastly, I would just point out that in both the Dash 8 and the Dash 5, there is a policy change that wasn't mentioned, and I would just point out that in the Dash 8, it's on page 5. Currently, all hospitals, the construction of any new hospital needs a certificate of need, including rural hospitals as defined in Oregon statute. Both the Dash 8s and the Dash 5s remove that requirement for a certificate of need for a new rural hospital. Mm-hmm. I'm just pointing that out as a policy change that we would point out. Other than that, Madam Chair, as I said, the department takes no position on the bill, and to the extent that I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to. To the extent that I'm unable, I can get specialists to get back to you in writing in the very near future.
Well, yes, Senator Marcet.
Okay, just one quick question. Dr. Grant Higginson was the hearings officer in Lane County when the certificate of need was being required of McKenzie Willamette because they were forced to move to a new territory. Peace Health did not need a certificate of need because they had enough base around the area. What I proposed was to do what Multnomah County has done, or what they do in the Portland area, not have a certificate of need within that area. Now that's what Dr. Higginson referred to by saying they are going back to a certificate of need now within that area, because there are movements occurring that was pretty stable for a while, but he indicated that there would once again be certificate of need for, I don't know what all the categories are. Now, can you speak to that? What's going on in Multnomah County?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I can only speak in a general sense. I was not with the agency at the time. I do recall that there were changes made to the administrative rules of certificate of need that addressed some of the unique situations that arose in Lane County. I can't speak specifically to what those changes mean in Multnomah County. I think it's safe to say, and staff will correct me, and I'll get back to you if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. is that the fundamental policy parameter within which we have to work, even with those rule changes, it would have to be a new hospital or some major relocation. It's not any more expansive under those rules, I don't believe, than what the statute sets out.
Yeah, my real question had to do with what's going on in Multnomah County, and I can find that out at some point, because I'm curious if they do indeed still have the certificate of need among the hospitals that are there, or if they... He indicated that they do not, and they were going back to it.
I will get clarification back to you in writing and make it available to the committee, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. There are some questions before we can move forward with this bill that I want answered. Just stay there in case so you can answer any of them. one is, you can't answer this, but I will get this one clarified. For those entities that are in process, I need to have that clarified, and I will be checking with legislative counsel for those that are in process.
Madam Chair, from an administrative point of view, if I may, yeah. I think that we as the administering agency would urge serious consideration of clarification about when it does take effect relative to projects that are already underway, et cetera. I think that's a very critical piece of equity.
Right, and that goes into my second, is actually when would this actually take effect? And then I want a little bit more clarification into the rules process, because I think there were some questions regarding definitions. What is a diagnostic center? What is a cancer center? And I'm sure that is in the rules rulemaking process, but I'm not sure who I would get that information from.
Madam Chair, I will make an inquiry on that. I will have an observation, though. perhaps this is, I think with respect to the definition of some of these facilities, it would be useful to consider a statutory definition as opposed to a rules-based definition. And for the following purpose, we currently operate statutorily that the term of art or the term hospital is defined in the ORS. Mm-hmm. I think as an agency, it would be better to have the legislature as the policymaking body of the state tell the agency what is an ambulatory surgery center, what is a diagnostic imaging center, what is an on. We would be more than helpful from a staff and specialist point of view to help you, Mr. Bacobian, and legislative council and others who may want to be involved in that. I think that leads to clarity in the administration. I also think that it probably gives some additional safeguards relative to it's the legislature speaking as opposed to, you know, Barney the bureaucrat or somebody like.
Hey, Barney the bureaucrat. Okay, the fourth thing is that there was concern regarding fees for the certificate of need, and I think you clarified that to a certain extent. But you know, when I hear 75 to 100,000, is that like for a hospital? And then I'd sort of like to get a general ballpark of what it would be for an ambulatory surgical center.
I will work with the health division staff and get you the existing fee schedule, since the scope of the we'll get back with you as much information and insight on that issue as possible.
The fifth question is the length of time. I know, again, there was, well, this takes such a long time, and I want to get that clarified, okay, too, probably. And then the appeals process. I need a little bit more. That's the sixth thing, a little bit more definition on the appeals process. And then just for the committee, you know, we are meeting at 5 o'clock for a short period of time to hopefully get through some of the bills that we can actually pass out. Maybe we'll have some of the questions answered. And then we are meeting Friday at 9 o'clock, too. So I plan to, I'm not sure when I can have all of these questions, but we'll probably be addressing this one on Friday morning.
Okay, we'll get to any of these we may be able to answer even informally by this evening. We'll try. Otherwise, we'll meet your Friday deadline.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay, Senator George.
Before you leave, do you agree that currently our facilities are delivering some of the lowest cost health care?
Senator, Madam Chair, Senator George, do you mean facilities? You mean hospital facilities or
hospitals, whether it's surgery centers or whatever? Overall,
Senator George, my experience, and I'm not a licensed, authorized health policy expert. I'm kind of a journeyman in this. I think historically, my perspective of healthcare in Oregon, specifically in the Northwest, generally, is that we have very efficient systems, both hospital systems and and in the development over the last decade or so of various ambulatory approaches, that when you look nationally, either at Medicare or others, that we tend to use resources more efficiently than other parts of the nation.
So we're doing pretty good up to the point that we had 503. I mean, obviously things look pretty good, pretty well balanced system.
Madam Chair, Senator George, on behalf of the department, we haven't got a position on
okay.
503. And when I joined the agency, I learned that my personal opinion doesn't count anymore.
Our costs are going up, just like everyone else's. This is.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. I think I can solve all the ambiguity here. Just make the whole bill go away. And quite simply, I think this is the solution in search of a problem. I can understand the desire for the Dash 5 amendment, and there may be at some point in time the fact that designer hospitals become an issue, but under the Dash 5 we're rolling in cancer centers and pain centers, and I don't think that's appropriate. Those are specific areas of business that I think need to stay specific. And as far as the Dash 8s, there's nothing in there I like. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I just love your opinion, Senator Kurz. Okay, with that, any other comments? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 503, and I'm going to open public hearing on Senate Bill 501.
And thank you all for coming. Megan Sweeney. No, who do I have first? And Shannon Callahan.
So do you like the threes on this one?
Yes, it's a three. Yes, that we're going to go with. Okay, 501.
Which room do you have for 501?
Okay, is that correct?
Oh, I have. 501 is five, and they have the dash twos, I think. Yes, go ahead and explain, Dr. Mr.
Thank you, Chair.
Sure.
We do have the Senate Bill 501, and in your packet are the dash two amendments which replace the bill. This bill requires insurance carriers provide an annual report to Department of Consumer Business Services, DCBS, on a number of issues, total number of members, premiums collected, total amount of cost for claims, etc. It would require the carriers submit this also information, aggregated financial information, general administrative expenses, surplus, maintained reserve, maintained unpaid claims. Would require that carriers submit this electronically and that the Health Insurance Reform Advisory Committee evaluate this information annually. And then would require DCBS to make reports available to public through a searchable internet website. This does have a ways and means referral on it, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Sweeney.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony. I am Megan Sweeney, Executive Director of the SEIU State Council in Oregon. On behalf of our 42,000 members, we support the passage of SB 501-2 amendments. Our intent in supporting SB 501 was to create a mechanism that would provide consumers and policymakers with additional information about rising health care costs. While 501-2 is a compromise, it's a fair compromise, and it remains a useful policy tool. 501-2 is the only mechanism currently available that describes premium dollars and premium increases by market segment. It will enable us to look at real data, which reveals premium increases over time. 501-2 is the only mechanism for interested parties to get information about medical loss ratio by market segment, the amount of premium dollars spent on health care. This information will be available on the web. 501-2 will create the only online source of an insurer's largest non-medical expenses. Much of 501-2 is based on a host of other information already provided by carriers to DCBS, but this information is contained in pages and pages of documents, much of which is not available unless visiting DCBS's office. This bill makes the information more useful without imposing any strenuous burdens on carriers or on DCBS. The committee is taking a serious look at disclosure and accountability. Health insurers should be a part of that. This is a worthy cause. We support the passage of the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Callahan. I'm the staff attorney and consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy group with over 33,000 members in the state of Oregon. I'm here today to urge your support for Senate Bill 501-2 amendments, which, as you know, requires insurance carriers to provide annual reports and certain information. This information will only seek to advance the consumer's interest for their ability to assess the stability and efficiency of health benefit plans throughout Oregon. It'll also increase accountability for the health plan, the health care plan market, and transparency. Therefore, on behalf of our membership, we urge you to support Senate Bill 501-2 amendments. We thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon.
Great. Thank you.
Any questions?
All right. I know the bill very well. Okay. John Pell, Lori Long, and Walt.
Samadura.
Go ahead, Lori.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, Lori Long with HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon. I'm joined today by Walt Samadoroff, our Director of Underwriting, and John Powell from Regents. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of the Dash 2 amendments and also the opportunity to come to terms with both SEIU and the Chair on amendments to this bill. We feel that we're supporting an effort towards increased transparency with the creation of this web-based report that summarized some of the key financial and premium information by carrier. We spent majority of the last 3.5 weeks working on these amendments. There were 9 entities on our side. I feel I should mention them by name. In addition to HealthNet and Regents, we were joined by Pacific Care, Providence, LifeWise, ODS, Pacific Source, Kaiser, and our trade association, America's Health Insurance Plans. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I just, again, want to thank the committee for its patience on this issue and allowing us time to not only work with Megan and the unions, but also work with the other health plans in assuring that we have a product here that can actually produce the kind of information that the sponsors of the bill wanted. I'd also just like to mention Pam Lally's name from Regents. She was the first one to contact Megan, and I think entered into a dialogue that created a very fruitful outcome. And Lori really finished the project up by getting the health plans together. And those are the two who did the real work on the bill.
Thank you.
We just got his letter. That's all.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
call. Madam Chair, my name is Walt Samadurov, and I'm the Director of Underwriting for HealthNet of Oregon. And I just want to commend and support the passage of this bill and that it's going to help the consumers, and it'll kind of force us to do some extra work in terms of reporting, but it's going to be a well worth it effort. Thank you.
Yes.
John Powell again from representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Lori has circulated some just very technical amendments with Megan. I think we're all in agreement that they will not violate any of the intent or what the bill actually does. We'll most likely, given the pressure on legislative council right now, want for you to just go ahead and pass the bill with the dash twos, and we would go ahead and make those very minor adjustments on the other side.
Yeah, usually I don't like to pass something out that's not good. Could you explain what those technical amendments are?
Sure. Okay. On page 1, line 20, there should be some reference that aggregate data is derived from the carrier's annual report. On page 1, line
from
the carrier's annual report, some reference back to that being the source for the information.
Okay.
And a part of this is, part of the intent of these amendments is to try to minimize the apples to oranges effect, if you will, so that the types of information that's being reported by carriers is consistent from plan to plan and useful to the end user when comparing reports.
Okay.
On page 1, line 13.
Page 1, line 13.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Under little a, big B, we would strike the word.
Page 2?
No.
Page 1,
mm-hmm.
line 13, mm-hmm. strike the word collected.
Mm.
And then that would be left to read total annual premiums.
Mm-hmm.
Page 1, line 14, strike the word paid. So it reads total amount of cost for claims. Page 1, line 16, strike the word paid again, so it reads the average amount of premiums per member per month. And then on page 1, line 18, strike the word paid. And additionally, we had some agreement in our conceptual amendments in the draft that we had discussed with SEIU that this portion, the percentage change from year to year, that the first year that would appear in the report would be in 2007, and that's not reflected in the amendment. On page 2, line 11, there should be some additional language that directs HIRAC to evaluate these particular reporting requirements by market segment. We didn't feel that was clear in how the amendment was drafted. None of these really substantially change where the direction of the dash twos.
the striking of the words collected and paid on the page one really just holds to some of the very technical terminology that we were pulling from our annual report for the purposes of these amendments, and brings clarity from the technical folks at our health plan so that they're clear on the direction of the statute and what is to be reported. Also gives HIRAC the kind of direction they need to make the recommendation to the director of DCBS that they're required to do under the bill.
What I would like to do is carry this over to Friday and to see if we could have the amendments. If not, we will pass it out on Friday. That is my preference, since we are meeting on Friday. If you could submit those, and then
ma'am,
yes,
could you repeat on page 2, line 11? I didn't get what you...
Sure. Yes. That portion of the amendment, let me pull out my copy. Subsection 3 of Section 2 is directing HIRAC to evaluate the information above in Section 2, sub 1, little a,
right,
by market segment. And we weren't clear that the language here is really directing not just HIRAC to evaluate A through D below,
okay,
but that there's a clear tie back to what's being reported, that this should be an evaluation by HIRAC by market segment. And that was a key piece in our negotiations with SEIU. We wanted to make sure that that was...
I wasn't sure if you said to cross something out or add something, but you were just talking the concept of you're going to change the wording in there.
Right,
so,
right.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. And we do have a letter from Jim
Davis.
Okay. All right, thank you. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 501, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 541A. And just a brief synopsis, this is a bill that we had already passed out to the floor and then realized there was a slight technical change, and so we're bringing it back, and we need to adopt the dash A3 amendments. So, Mr. Berkovian, do you want to just make a brief statement on that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. These do, briefly, the dash A3s, and this would have to, again, be amended to the dash 501A engrossed version. These do include the task force recommendations that that the task force would have to address claims payment compliancy with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, electronic transaction code regulations as part of their charge. And the other technical fix just clarifies that the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research may apply for and receive contributions for carrying out duties. Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Any questions?
We'd also have to rescind the
approval. Okay.
For approval.
Now, what we do need to do is rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, I
wait, just a minute. What?
Have to go to a work session.
I am in this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Then
first adopt the
A3.
We're going to move
okay.
503.
Pardon? Huh? Okay, we need the A3s.
To move the A3s.
To adopt the A3s to the bill.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt dash three amendments to the bill Senate Bill 541.
A 541,
okay, as amended. Yes.
Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Portman?
Yes.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Frank Morse. Oh, I'm just looking for the bill. Yeah, I'll say aye on the amendments, yes.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Chair Montana?
Aye. Motion carried. Frank Morse will...
No, wait,
no. Now.
Madam Chair, yes. I move Senate Bill 541 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Without the with the approval of the President.
Okay. Senator Morissette has moved a 541 as amended with the dash 3 amendments, rescinding the referral to Ways and Means with approval from the President's office. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. Motion carries, and Frank Morris will be carrying this bill. Now, on I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 541A, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 819. Now, committee, we need to rescind an amendment that we had passed, and then we're going to adopt the Dash 3 amendments
Madam
to it.
Chair,
Senator
are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended and the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments were adopted to Senate Bill 819 on April 18th be reconsidered.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves that rules be suspended and the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments were adopted to Senate Bill 819 on April 8th be reconsidered. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Still you, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes. Those are the opinion. Okay, that the rules be suspended. We already said
that.
We did
that. We're done.
All right.
Okay.
That motion carries.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 819.
All right. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 819. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I think this makes this distinct to where we wanted it originally. It deals with vaccines, and I think this is an appropriate bill which will have success in both sides of this building.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that Dash 3 is a complete gut and stuff.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And I think the report here with Kate Newell in it is the accurate description of the amendment.
Okay. Do you want to explain it, Mr. Westland? Senator Westland?
Hello. That's good timing.
It's perfect timing for Senate Bill 819. And Senator Bates. All right.
We can get out of here before Bates shows up.
We are on Senate Bill 819. We're in work session, and we just need a little brief description of this. We do understand it's going to Ways and Means.
Good bill should pass. That enough?
That's enough.
Perfect.
Okay.
I wrote all the testimony as opposed to copying it up. I'll just say better bill should pass quicker.
I think the question was, what are the Dash 3s referred to, right?
Please give the committee a little bit of description.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This section of the Dash 3s, I'd like you to turn to page 2, section 4, and what this essentially implements is a joint interim legislative task force to study, and more importantly, or just as importantly, to make recommendations to the 74th Legislative Assembly regarding the long-term viability and, please excuse the pun, efficacy of health care services in Oregon. This would include access to care, the Oregon Health Plan, delivery systems, and administrative efficiencies. I want to stress that this is in no way intended to supplant the good work and mission of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, of which I am a member and proud to serve, but rather to augment each other's work, where the sum of the parts would be greater than the whole. I'd also like to say that I think this amendment allows us to take advantage of what I think is one of the great benefits of our biannual sessions, our biannual system, and that being a long interim where we can, unlike the regular session where we're all pulled from pillar to post, take advantage in a more collaborative and contemplative fashion and discuss and make recommendations to what I think is truly the biggest issue facing not only this state but this nation, health care. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, I'm really supportive of the Dash 3s. If you'd have talked any longer, though, I might have changed my mind.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Yeah, I did get a copy of these, but I'm not sure everybody did before the meeting, and the question did come up on the committee that we... And Mr. Bacobian was about to explain it when you walked in the door.
Okay.
Great. Yes?
Madam Chair, I'd like to make one quick comment. I'm not going to add to what the good senator to my right has said. I agree wholeheartedly. You will find in Section 2 something that might make you think, what the heck is this?
That's necessary.
And it is necessary. This is a fix of language in the bill we passed last session, the Organ Patient Safety Commission, and we made a mistake in that, in the language of it, what made it almost impossible for us to fund this from the sources it was supposed to be funded from, which are other funds, no general fund money. This allows that to take place. It puts a limit on it, makes it a reasonable way to go, and it's just an error we made last time. It, relating to clause, this bill was wide enough we could use it, so we plugged it in here for passage. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment, Senate Bill 819.
Senator Cruz moves the -3, Senate Bill 819. Discussion? Opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 819 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. It's got that spending limitation. At least it's going to
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 819 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Montana?
Motion carries.
You didn't vote.
Aye.
Okay, that's great.
Motion carries. Okay.
Can't abstain.
Colleagues, it's 5 minutes till we will. We are going to recess until 5 o'clock. Just cover a few of these bills. It won't probably be more than a half hour, 45 minutes, and then those that we don't carry over. We will hear Friday morning at 9. Is that
clear out of here, though, right?
Yes. So I'd like to recess and reconvene in hearing room E at 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm.